Making sure dogs have homes isn't just about the dogs.
In the shelter world, there are more and more people realizing that the problems with unwanted animals is not an isolated problem. It's related to people problems. And people problems that create dogs that have to be surrendered or dogs that are stray are people who they can't afford vet care or they can't afford to get their dog spayed and neutered.
That's Amy Sutherland. We talk with her about dogs in shelters, getting them adopted, and keeping them out of shelters to begin with. We also talk about some of the wonderful dogs she's rescued and rehabilitated during the years she's been a shelter volunteer. Her book is Rescuing Penny Jane, One Shelter Volunteer, Countless Dogs, and the Quest to Find Them All Homes. Then we give equal time to cats. We re-air part of our interview with cat behaviorist Sarah Ellis about her book, The Trainable Cat. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and on the web at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. It used to be that most dogs that came into shelters were put down, but no more. Since the spread of the no-kill shelter, more dogs are being rehomed, but also more dogs need homes than shelters can find. It's even harder when you consider how stressed so many homeless dogs are. Fear creates negative behaviors, which makes them more difficult to adopt, and the longer they stay in a shelter, the worse it can get. The animal shelter system is making big changes, from how shelters are designed to retraining and treating negative behaviors in dogs, and even to helping people keep their dogs instead of surrendering them. Journalist Amy Sutherland knows this system well. She's been a shelter volunteer for years and has fostered and adopted many shelter dogs. One of them is Penny Jane, a dog initially so scared of people, Sutherland and her husband had to studiously ignore her, other than feeding her, for almost a year before Penny Jane felt safe enough to accept their attention. Sutherland's book, Rescuing Penny Jane, melds the genres of memoir, history, and how-to to talk about the shelter system, her experiences with it, and how you can adopt the best shelter dog for you. Amy Sutherland is the author of several previous books, including Kicked, Bitten, and Scratched, and What Shamu Taught Me About Life, Love, and Marriage. Rescuing Penny Jane is her fourth book and is out from HarperCollins. Well, Amy Sutherland, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much for having me, Francesca.
Well, this book, Rescuing Penny Jane, is just a terrific book, filled with so much information, a real perspective I don't think a lot of people get, and terrific stories. Tell us first about Penny Jane herself. That she's one of your dogs.
Right.
Let's start out by telling us about her.
Well, the book is titled for her because we adopted her almost 15 years ago, and she came to us as a dog that was basically unsocialized. She had lived on a farm as a puppy, and she was almost 8 months old when she came into the shelter. And we adopted her. When we adopted her, we didn't really understand what that meant. Of course, now I do. But what it meant was that she really had a lot of trouble adjusting to being a pet in a house. She was just terrified, mostly, of being inside with us. So as you read the book, you'll see we worked out some of those kinks. It took a long time and a lot of stress. But she was really the sort of high water mark as far as what I had ever done for a dog before, and a real test of what I was willing to do. And it really opened my eyes to how much I was willing to give a dog, if that makes sense. And so that sort of launched me, you know, once I knew how much patience I had and what I was willing to do, it really changed the ballgame.
So say a little bit about that process. What were the issues you were confronting with her?
Well, you know, she was pretty okay outside because she had grown up outside. But as a dog that had missed this crucial window as a young puppy of being around humans, she found humans pretty terrifying. So when she was in our house, she was always running from us, hiding from us, just very confused and trouble with stairs and trouble going in and out of doors and just the most common things you would expect a dog to be able to do. The only thing she was happy about inside is when we fed her. So we didn't really know how to handle this. And as I recount in the book, you know, it took me some time to get a handle on it. And what we realized was that the biggest favor we could do for her was to ignore her and not even look at her. So we let her become a ghost in our house, essentially, and let her come around to us. So we went on what I always say, we went on Penny Jane time. People always think they have to be in control and in charge of their dogs, and basically we handed all the control over to her so that she could just learn to be comfortable with us.
How long did that take?
Oh, God. I think, you know, she did it so slowly. So I would say after about 6-7 months, you know, when we got used to ignoring her, she was not as freaked out in the house, and we got used to just letting her be around. So first we were the ones that got used to it, and then once she settled in, I guess maybe a year, and then it was still bits and pieces after that. She's never been a cuddly dog, and that might just be her personality, who knows, but she can do anything, and she's always liked to be around people, but she'd really prefer it if you didn't pet her.
Wow, that's so interesting. Now, really, this is very much an issue of socialization, something that you talk about in the book. How do dogs become socialized?
Well, the easy way is, you know, up to about, I think it's about 12 weeks, maybe a little bit longer, puppies are really willing to accept every experience as just being something as a part of the world and something to learn about. After that window closes, the puppy mind starts to consider everything as a new and maybe threatening experience. It's not something they just will easily accept. So if you, for example, have kept your dog inside and it's never really been around other dogs, and then you don't understand why you ended up with a dog that is either nervous or aggressive around other dogs, it's because they weren't exposed to dogs at this key window. And unfortunately, a lot of the dogs that we see, especially in New England, who come into the shelter, have been under-socialized in some way. So what people often think of is like, oh, this dog is crazy, or this dog just has a bad personality, or blah, blah, blah. It's usually got to do with how they were brought up.
You've written a book about and spent many, many hours of your life, years of your life, working with dogs that were under-socialized and bringing them to a place where they were years after this critical window was passed. What does it take to do that?
It takes a tremendous amount of patience, and it takes sort of learning how to see the world from the dog's point of view. So, you know, there's some dogs who, when they're under-socialized, are very scared of humans. And one of the things you have to learn is in dog body language what seems sort of aggressive or bold, and that is looking a dog right in the eye or approaching a dog, facing them forward. So, like when I'm in the shelter and a dog is nervous, I know to turn my body sideways, to cast my eyes down, to do all these things that the dog will read as body language that I'm chill, I'm not going to bother you. It's pretty much you sort of start talking to the dog in dog language. And then, you know, so you're always going to just sort of be thinking about how they are seeing the world. And to me, honestly, that's part of what's kept me so engaged with working with shelter dogs is I just find that process endlessly interesting and intellectually compelling.
Yeah, and, you know, it's interesting what you say because I remember when I volunteered in a shelter several years ago. It was a stressful experience for me because nobody taught me any of this.
Yeah, that's very common, unfortunately. A lot of shelter volunteers, shelters mean well, but they sort of throw people into the mix. And, depending on the kinds of dogs that you have in your shelter, that might work out okay. But, you know, a lot of dogs in shelters are, even in the best shelters, they're under stress. So it's kind of like, what would be the parallel? I mean, you know, if you're going to go into a party, so you're going to go room in full a room of people, but they're at a party, you know, it's pretty easy, right, to get along with those people. But if you're going to go into a room of people that are anxiously waiting something to happen, say they're waiting to find out what happened to their family member in a hospital, it's going to be a totally different experience interacting with those people. And that's how you got to think of, like, a lot of these dogs in the shelter. They're under a lot of stress.
Yeah, one of the points you make in the book is that shelters aren't necessarily designed well to decrease the stress. So talk about good and bad design in shelters.
Well, they didn't do that, you know, to be mean, but, you know, it used to be back in the day when a lot of these shelters were built, they were built for volume, and it was when the shelter world was really overwhelmed with how many homeless animals there were. And this is in the age, unfortunately, in the 70s and the 80s and before, that a lot of shelters were putting animals down for lack of space. So nobody, no dogs or cats were expected to be there longer than a week, and many would be there far less than that. So they were sort of just designed to be hosed down easily and to for the worker to use them as quickly as they could. Now, you know, the good, you know, the thing is now we're in the world of no-kill, where a lot of these shelters keep these animals, dogs and cats, for months. You know, I write about a dog in my book who basically lived his entire life out at a shelter. But these facilities were not designed for that kind of amount of time for a dog to be in. And so you have these hard concrete walls that are amplify all the barking. You have these, chain link kennel doors that tend to bring out what we call barrier aggression in some dogs. I'm trying to think of other things. It's just that it wasn't that well designed. But now there are, you know, when newer shelters go up, they're built with the idea to make the dogs as comfortable as they can.
And how do they do that?
Well, I was just in one. I was up at the shelter that I first started volunteering at, which is called the Animal Refuge League of Greater Portland, Maine. And they just built this brilliant building. And it was so encouraging to see. So they did things like they put glass doors that are soundproofed on the kennel doors. So the glass makes it so that the dog doesn't feel like he's at a barrier, which makes him calmer and not so crazy at his gate. And it also tamps down the noise. And they set up the kennels so that dogs that have trouble with other dogs, that they can be positioned in these kennels where when they need to go outside, they go directly to an outside door as opposed to, say, walking down a whole row of kennels with, you know, that's often when dogs who have trouble with other dogs get really out of control and start barking and lunging at the other dogs in their kennels. So really practical stuff, you know, it's not rocket science.
Yeah, and it also extends to the places and the ways that people meet the animals, people right. who are looking for dogs.
Yeah, I saw there's a lot of great examples of how shelters are improving their ways to introduce dogs. And one of them is at the Animal Humane in Greater Minneapolis. And they, oh, I hope I said their name right, because they all have similar names. They have this beautiful, well-lit area with these rooms with, like, these gorgeous sliding doors. I mean, it looks like something out of an Apple store. And then all these volunteers swarming around with iPads who can help you adopt your dog right then so you're not standing in some long line at a counter, you know, for a couple hours to get your dog. They've made it a more, you know, I hate this term, but user-friendly experience, where in the past it was almost like, oh, I don't know. I don't know if you've had this experience, but it can, you know, you can sort of feel like either you're in a melee of people trying to, you know, meet dogs, or you're sort of like handed a dog and gruffly, you know, told to fill out a piece of paper and, you know, pushed out the door with this dog you hardly know. You know, those days are, in many places, are long past.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with best-selling author Amy Sutherland about her latest book, Rescuing Penny Jane, One Shelter Volunteer, Countless Dogs, and the Quest to Find Them All Homes. So let's go back to some of the dogs. You say that shelters are really in the business of treating fear, and you talk about one dog, Coconut. You have incredibly vivid descriptions of what it feels like from the dog's perspective, and this chapter really made it come alive. Talk about her.
Well, Coconut is at a center that's been run by the ASPCA, started a few years ago, and it was to bring in the most fearful dogs, ones that basically hardly any shelter was capable of handling. And these are the kind of dogs that are coming out of hoarding cases or dog fighting cases. And, you know, they wanted to find the best way to treat these animals to help them get over their fear in a shelter. And so they were having really – these dogs are having the most extreme demonstrations of fear. So in Coconut's case, you know, I talk about the fact that when trainers would sit with her, they would just sit in a room with her. They weren't even trying to pet her. They were just sitting quietly. And Coconut would just tear around the room as if it was on fire trying to get out. I mean, just being in a room with a person was overwhelmingly terrorizing to her. And, you know, I mean, for me personally, it's really helped me understand the strength of fear and its effect on dogs to see such extreme cases. They had another dog, now I'm going to forget his name, who used to, he would become so fearful when a trainer was nearby that he would kind of look like he had gone into kind of a coma. You know, he would sort of sit up on his back haunches and just sort of fall over to the side from the stress of being with these people.
Yeah. Now, these dogs back in the day would have been killed.
Yeah, easily.
Yeah. So talk a little bit about the kill versus no kill issues. I mean, there's a fair amount of controversy around the whole issue. Tell us about it.
Well, there's a lot of controversy, and then there's also, which of course goes along with the controversy, there's a lot of misunderstanding of it outside the shelter world, inside the shelter world. So no kill by some shelters and by, I think, the public at large is taken as a literal statement, like no animals are put down ever at this facility. That's almost an impossible dream for a lot of facilities because some of these animals come in and they are either really medically in a situation where they need to be humanely euthanized or they are so behaviorally troubled that they're not safe to adopt out to, say, your average family. So the thinking in the shelter world, the sort of standard is if you have 90% of your animals leave the building alive, either through adoption or transfer, that you can call yourself no kill. And the thinking is that accommodates the animals that are in the position that are, because of their behavior or their health, need to be put down. And it works on this assumption that there is 10% of the population that's probably going to fall into that category. So this creates all kinds of misunderstandings in the sense that most of the public doesn't understand that. And then in the shelter world, you know, the places that call themselves no-kill often get more donations than places like, say, city facilities that have to take in every single animal that shows up on their doorstep legally, so may not have the resources or kennel room to, you know, to be no-kill even if they want to be. So it creates – I mean, the good thing about no-kill is, as Rich Avezzino, who's this, like, amazing pioneer of no-kill in this country, puts it, it gives the shelter world a goal to work for. And for much of its history, it didn't have that until we did have that. So no-kill is got its issues, but I think it's better to have it than not by a long shot.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Amy Sutherland about her book, Rescuing Penny Jane, One Shelter Volunteer, Countless Dogs, and the Quest to Find Them All Homes. Now, when I volunteered in a shelter, almost all, not all, but I'd say a good 80% of the dogs were pit bulls. And in fact, that's true. You say in this book that there are many, many dogs that are pit bulls. Why is that? And why maybe is that, you know, maybe they've gotten a bad rap.
Yeah, well, they've totally gotten a bad rap. And one of the things, the biggest things I wish people would keep in mind about, you know, what, you know, people call pit bulls or pit bull mixes is that by and large, these dogs are not purebreds. They are mishmashes of bulldog, boxer, lab, you have it. I think, you know, the thinking is that in the parts of the country where people aren't fixing their dogs, and so that there are still, you know, unintended litters born, that this is sort of the new look of what the mutt looks like, the American mutt. In the past, we had, you know, and I still think this is true in some other parts of the country, we had a lot of dogs that looked like what we would call shepherd mixes. Mm-hmm. That was sort of a look for a mutt when I was growing up, and the other one was these kind of vaguely labby mixes. You still see those, especially coming out of the South. So these dogs are mixes, and the way that DNA works, which I only kind of understand, I have to admit, is that, you know, DNA is like, it doesn't sort of predictably put bits of breeds here and there. You know, like a DNA doesn't go, oh, you're part Ridgeback, you're going to have a nice little line of raised fur down your back. Or, you know, you're a Cocker Spaniel, so you're going to have these long ears. The DNA just kind of takes these genes for all these breeds and, like, puts it through a cuisine art and, you know, whatever, you know, and then throws it wherever it goes. So as soon as you have a mutt, what this, you know, dog is really just a one of a kind, and you can't project a lot of behavior ideas on that dog.
Yeah, so the pit bull, and why have so many of them ended up in shelters?
I think that a lot of them, you know, ended up in shelter because we tend to get a lot of animals into shelters out of low-income areas. And in low-income areas, people have had these types of dogs as what they would think of as, like, you know, guard dogs. But they've let them roam, and then they end up with unintended litters of puppies. But, you know, people aren't really sure why, because they're showing up in parts of the country that are rural, too. So it's kind of a mystery. But the point is maybe not to ask about where they came from, but to think about how we can get them adopted and find them homes, because they totally deserve them.
You also talk about the link between poverty, I mean, not just in this way, but the link between poverty and the increase in sheltered dogs, because with so many people falling out of the middle class or maybe never making it into it, they can't afford to keep their dogs.
Right. I mean, you know, in the shelter world, there are more and more people realizing that the problems with unwanted animals is not an isolated problem. It's related to people problems. And people problems that create dogs that have to be surrendered or dogs that are stray are people who, you know, they can't afford vet care or they can't afford to get their dog spayed and neutered. There's not vets in a lot of neighborhoods that are low income. So it's not, it may be just a simple question of transportation. They can't get this dog to a vet, even if they could afford it or want to. People lose their jobs. People get evicted. Sometimes, you know, people have a landlord that decides that all of a sudden they can't have a dog anymore. And, you know, if you don't have a lot of resources, it's really hard. And I think that the biggest thing people need to do is to quit being so judgmental, because as long as we are judgmental, we won't be able to help these people keep their animals. And I think the trend in the shelter world is to recognize that we got to quit being judgmental about these people and reach out and maybe, you know, get our hands a little dirty with some people problems.
You write in about an amazing program in South Los Angeles.
Oh, yeah.
Tell us about that.
This is one of the most sort of heart It was just really heartening programs I came across. It's called Downtown Dog Rescue. It was started and founded by this amazing woman named Lori Weiss, who used to help homeless people in L.A. on Skid Row with their dogs that they had. And then she changed it. She built it into a program for finding dogs from the hardest parts of the city, homes, or helping them stay in their homes. And so the newest sort of outlet of that is that Downtown Dog Rescue has a staff person who is at one of the L.A. shelters, the one in South Los Angeles that has a huge amount of volume. And when people bring their dogs in to give them up, the city clerks say, you should go talk to Amanda and see if there's some way she can help you keep your dog. And they have helped just thousands of people keep their dogs by helping them with largely with vet bills, sometimes with housing issues. Sometimes it's things like, you know, people had their car impounded, and now that they don't have their car, they can't go to work, which means they can't, you know, have enough money for the dog food. And, you know, and they just found that a lot of people were bringing their dogs in because they had these insurmountable, what seemed to them insurmountable problems in their own life. And by somebody helping them with those problems, they are more than happy to keep their animals.
Yeah, it's really beautiful. Now, you have a lot of practical tips in this book for people, not just ones about, you know, dog behavior and how to deal with it, but also tips on adopting dogs from shelters. Give us a few of them.
I think the biggest thing when you're going to adopt a dog from a shelter is to be not just sort of go with your eyes, but really be realistic with, you know, the type of dog that you would be best suited for. So you want to think primarily, I think, about a dog's energy level. You know, do you want a dog that's going to need to lay around during the day? You know, be honest with yourself. You know, can you really take a border collie type dog? The next thing I think is, you know, people obsess over size. I don't think size is so much an issue. I think really the energy is. But then the other thing is like, you know, what are these dogs' issues in the shelter? And, you know, how much are you realistically up for? You know, some people fall in love with a dog and they find out, like I did with Penny Jane, and they find out that they are, you know, up for what might be a rough ride for a week or two. But, you know, if you really just want to bring home what we call a plug and play, you know, then, you know, you probably want a puppy, or oftentimes the older dogs are plug and plays. And then the other thing is there's another way to help shelter dogs, is there's a whole other category, and that is, you know, really old dogs. Really old dogs do not get adopted at the rate that younger dogs do. And, you know, that's a real, you know, if you want to do more than adopt a dog and you really want to help one, you might want to think of an older dog that might, you know, be a little more expensive at the vet, but might be easy to handle, and you'd be really helping them out.
Oh, that's great. Now, you look forward to a time when all dogs have homes.
Yeah.
What's it going to take to get to that point?
Well, I wrote my book hoping to inspire more people to get involved, because it's, you know, there's lots of people, far more than in the past, that are adopting shelter dogs and rescue dogs. So that's fantastic. But I think what we need is more people just to embrace and get involved in the whole movement and think of it as a community-wide problem and as a community that we should solve it. So there's lots of ways people can get involved beyond just walking dogs at the local shelter. I mean, they need donors. They need people who might work on legislative issues such as banning puppy mills or regulating puppy mills more strictly. You can get involved with national organizations like Best Friends or Maddie's Fund or the ASPCA, or you can get involved with your local outlet. And certainly, you know, it's a little trickier, but certainly all our municipal and county facilities need a lot more love and care. And for people to, you know, these are often facilities people avoid because they are, quote, you know, unquote, not, you know, kill facilities. And I really hate that when people apply it to city facilities, because they are in a situation where they are compelled to take all the animals that come in but have very few resources. So like in the city of Boston and in most cities, if I license my dog when I license my dog, I not only get ID on her, but that money for the license directly funds animal control. So if you license your dog, you're helping your animal control budget.
Well, your book, Amy Sutherland, is Rescuing Penny Jane, One Shelter Volunteer, Countless Dogs, and the Quest to Find Them All Homes. Thanks so much for talking with us here.
Oh, thanks for talking dogs with me. I really appreciate it.
Amy Sutherland. Go to writersvoice.net to read an excerpt from Rescuing Penny Jane. Next up, we re-air an edited version of our 2016 interview with Sarah Ellis about her book, The Trainable Cat. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Some people are dog lovers. Some love cats. Others, like me, love both. In today's first segment, we talked about dogs. Now, let's hear a long excerpt from my 2016 interview with cat behaviorist Sarah Ellis, talking about the book she co-wrote with biologist John Bradshaw, The Trainable Cat, A Practical Guide to Making Life Happier for You and Your Cat. Dogs have owners, cats have staff, right? The whole notion that you can train a cat may seem preposterous, especially to those who take the view that cats are diabolical manipulators who make their humans into putty in their paws. But my guest, Sarah Ellis, says cats are trainable, and training them is important for the mental health of our companion kitties as well as for ourselves. Many cats are now confined indoors their whole lives to protect them from traffic or to protect birds from them. Others are shut in at night to keep them safe from predators. And while a dog's place is with its owner, cats are highly territorial and feel comfortable only at home. Hence the struggles over getting them into cat carriers and the howls of protest that endure throughout the car ride to wherever we're taking them. Sarah Ellis and her co-author biologist John Bradshaw, he wrote the best-selling book Cat Sense, show how easy and fun it is to train cats once we understand their true nature. Sarah Ellis, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Hello, thank you.
Your book, The Trainable Cat, A Practical Guide to Making Life Happier for You and Your Cat, came as a surprise to me because I thought, like I think many people, that cats are untrainable. You know, the idea dogs have people, cats have staff?
Yes.
So cats are trainable?
Yes, they are. Yeah, they completely are. And I totally understand where you're coming from. It's a belief that lots of people have. And it's partly, I think, come about because, one, we haven't recognized maybe the need to train cats. Previously, if we look back historically, cats lived very much sort of on the periphery of our lives. Rodent catchers often put out at night. Now they're very much a cherished member of the family, often sleeping in our bedrooms, on our beds, even in our beds. And with that change in role has come the need to make sure that they're well looked after and that they have good veterinary care. And there, in some countries, there are now pressures to make sure that you keep your cat inside at nighttime. And so with all this change in role has come these things that we now expect cats to do, to go in the cat carrier, to go to the veterinarian office, to come in at nighttime. And suddenly we find actually it's quite difficult to get cats to do those things, but it needn't be because we can train them. And I think the second thing is we haven't really recognised that they can be trained because they're not necessarily as socially motivated to be around us or to please us as dogs traditionally are. And that's come from their evolution, from having evolved from a solitary ancestor. But that doesn't mean to say that they don't learn in exactly the same way as a dog or any other mammal. It just means that we have to make sure that we've got other rewards beyond things that are social.
So what are some of the rewards that really motivate a cat?
Food. Every owner will know that their cat loves food. And actually, because if we look at the ethology of how cats would eat when they're free ranging, they're the perfect animal to train because as a hunter, and a hunter of small prey, a solitary hunter that would catch small rodents, they eat small meals often. So as opposed to having one large meal a day, they feed in these sort of small portions, little and often. And that's perfect for training, because in training, we want to be able to have the opportunity to reward lots of good behavior. And that's done by giving lots of little and often, little and frequent pieces of food. So food is by far the greatest motivator and our best tool for training cats. But for other cats, play is also really, really rewarding and reinforcing. And even although I've said as a whole, as a species, cats are not necessarily as socially motivated as other pets such as dogs, within that species there are individuals that are very, very social and will find attention from us as in the form of, for example, being scratched under their chin, rewarding, and rewarding enough that they are motivated to work for it. Then there's all the quirks of the individual cats. My cat Cosmos very much likes to facial rub on a grooming brush, and that is rewarding enough for him that he will work to do that.
It's interesting. I have a cat who I got at 4 months old. I was told that she had been brought in from the wild. It took quite a while to socialize her, but she has become so social that it is surprising to me. And I did figure out very early on that she was able to learn her name. So I wanted to ask you, you know, so many of us do get cats and kittens that, you know, have been brought into shelters. Talk a little bit about, you know, the kitten and what kinds of things can make a kitten more amenable to being trained, no matter where they've come from.
Okay. There's two things there. Firstly, you're really lucky that your cat has been turned into a really sociable cat, because having come from the wild, it's likely that its parents were feral, were not pet cats. And therefore, we know cats that have genetics from feral, from untamed cats, from wild cats, are less likely to show social behaviour. The way that we can help them and train them to realise that people are actually friendly and nothing to fear is to make sure that we get early socialization into these kittens. Kittens are most receptive to learning about the world around them, including the social world, from about 2 to about 7 weeks of age. It's what we call a sensitive period. So for individuals, it will vary slightly. So I know you said you didn't get your kitten until he was 16 weeks, did you say?
Yeah, she was 4 months, yeah.
And therefore, they are still receptive to learning at that time, but they're not in the real peak period where those brains are really plastic. But for any kitten, to make sure it's most amenable to training, we want to make sure that it's not scared of people and that it's had lots of gentle but positive experiences of meeting different people in that early period from about 2 weeks onwards. If a kitten does not have that, then if that kitten is from wild parentage, that kitten will remain feral for the rest of its life. It may be possible to tame it and to accept one or two people that it lives with, but it won't view all the visitors to the home as positive people. So early socialization is the key to that animal learning that people are positive, and then also making them much more receptive to training later on.
Well, she must be a remarkable cat, because she's very, very friendly. And since I've been actually following some of the precepts that we'll be talking about that you discuss in this wonderful book, The Trainable Cat, I found that she loves to be trained. And so actually, it's not even a chore necessarily. A cat, it seems to me that she derives real pleasure from our training sessions.
That's really lovely to hear. And I'm actually hearing that quite a lot from owners, which is, it's really nice. It's my reward, if you like. And yeah, for me, that's not surprising, because I've been doing it for so many years with my cats. But I think a lot of owners have gone into it thinking, I've got a duty of care to do this because I don't want my cat to be stressed, but it might be a bit of a chore. It's another homework task. And it doesn't need to be at all. But as soon as they quickly see how much their cat enjoys it and how it starts to change their relationship with their cat, because their cat starts to perceive them differently, wants to be around them more, is more engaging, it becomes so rewarding for cat and owner. And it becomes a bit addictive then. You're sort of ready to teach the cat the new thing. And certainly my cat's always around me going, hey, what are we going to do? We're going to do some training now. And it can really, really enhance that relationship.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with the cat behaviorist, Dr. Sarah Ellis, about the book she co-authored with John Bradshaw, The Trainable Cat. Now, I think before I came across your book, I was clueless about any kind of training. And so there were times in which I would yell at her when she did something wrong and she'd run out of the room. And I thought, well, you know, that's great. She's learning that she shouldn't do it. Talk about punishment and how that's maybe a no-no.
Okay. So exactly. If you yelled at your cat for doing something you didn't want her to do, let's say it was, clawing the furniture, the act of you shouting in a loud voice, as you've rightly said, stops her doing that behavior. And makes her leave the room. But it doesn't, it doesn't stop the motivation to perform that behavior. What she might learn to do instead is to do the behavior when you're not around, but still scratch the furniture. Or she might find an alternative place. But the most important thing from a welfare point of view is that she does not differentiate in her mind, you are just shouting at me because I scratched that furniture. She thinks in her mind, wow, sometimes you shout at me. And that's actually quite a scary thing. And therefore, I'm not sure when you're going to shout at me. So I'm not sure I want to be around you at all anymore. And I actually feel a bit anxious in your presence. So yes, we might be able to stop the behavior if we're lucky. But at the same time, we're really damaging our relationship with our cats and potentially putting our cats into a constant state of generalized anxiety. And that's a complete no-no from our welfare point of view. No owner wants that for their cat.
And I think that points up one of the other, central ideas of your book, and that is that training is a way to help cats adapt to an unnatural environment for them. Is that right?
Completely, yeah. I mean, we have to accept with the cat, we have not fully domesticated it to the same extent that we have domesticated pet dogs. So we have an animal that is still very capable of living without us, living within our homes. And because we're still on that sort of cusp of domestication with this animal, we've never artificially selected for traits that would make it genetically adaptable for this life. So we have to train it. So there are many things that we expect cats to do that their natural biology has not set them out to do. For example, traveling in fast motion cars within cat carriers is not something natural for a cat. So therefore, I believe we have a duty of care to teach it that this should not be something that is frightening for a cat.
Well, that's the perfect place to then introduce the 9 skills that form the foundation for training cats. We may not get to all 9 of them, but I wanted to do it within the context of the cat carrier.
Okay.
My cat, when I brought her home, when she was just a little fluff, and she was in the carrier that the shelter had, by the time I got home, which was about a 15-minute car ride, the carrier was utterly demolished. And she has really hated, I mean, now she's 4 years old. She really, really hates to go in the cat carrier. And I had just despaired of ever being able to train her to do that. So I did try to put in treats, but she completely ignored the treats. And then I tried taking it apart and putting treats in that way, and she still completely ignored the treats. I do have to say that following your plan, she is now sleeping in the bottom half of her cat carrier.
That's lovely to hear.
So we have some success. But put this in the context of the skills. If you know, what would be with a cat that is so averse to something like a cat carrier, what are the foundational skills that you would use to train the cat to be more friendly toward it?
Okay, so if we're starting off with a cat that's already fearful of the cat carrier, the first thing I would suggest is that you change the cat carrier, because that relationship of being associating the cat carrier with negative events such as traveling, going to the vets, going to the boarding cattery, has going to have been built up over a long period of time and is going to be really, really well established. So we're going to have a better chance of getting the cat to accept going in a cat carrier if we use a brand new cat carrier. That also means we've got a carrier that isn't full of the scent that the cat produces when it's scared. So cats have scent glands in between their toes, behind their cheeks, behind their whiskers on their cheeks, sorry, in front of their ears on those bald patches and under their chin. And one of the key skills is about impregnating scent, that cats produce certain chemicals known as pheromones that they facially rub on objects and deposit these pheromones. And that makes them feel safe and secure. But they also can produce another kind of pheromone when they are frightened. And so we want to get rid of any of those smells, because if the cat smells a carrier and it has got a scent in it that suggests to the cat it was scared the last time it was in there, it's not going to want to go anywhere near that again. So let's start with a brand new cat carrier. And let's use the key skill of impregnating it with the cat's scent. So we do that by just putting on a very fine cotton glove and stroking your cat around those facial regions, scratching under the chin if that's what your cat enjoys, or rubbing along the side of its cheeks, or stroking the top of the head. Then we take that glove and then we rub it all over the inside and the outside of the cat carrier. So we're not taking the cat over to the cat carrier at all. They don't even have to be in the same room at this point. We're simply just trying to get the cat's scent onto the carrier. Then what we want to do is break the carrier down into its simplest form, as you said. So make sure that we've just got the base of the cat carrier. So we've purchased one that is the top can be completely removed. And we want to place that in the home in a place that is considered by the cat to be safe and secure, a nice quiet spot, not somewhere that they would, if they were in the carrier, they would get easily startled. So not near a front door or a washing machine or anything like that. And then our key skill number one described in the book is to allow voluntary exploration. Now, when we say exploration, we are not expecting this cat to march straight up to that cat carrier and give it a good sniff, not if it's had a previous negative experience of cat carriers. We might, at this stage, our exploration might simply be a fleeting glance in the direction of that cat carrier, and that we would reward. And what we do is we then reward by something called shaping, which is rewarding successive approximations of this final behaviour that we want. In our case, it's to get the cat voluntarily going into the cat carrier. So initially, we might just reward a tiny glance at the cat carrier. And then if at some stage the cat looks at it for longer, we reward that. If they move in a direction closer to it, we reward that, and so forth, until we're moving towards the cat being closer and closer to the cat carrier. For a cat that's previously been scared of the cat carrier, I wouldn't use lures, and lures are where you use food or another reward and move it in the direction of the cat carrier to entice the animal towards it. And the reason I wouldn't do that is, one, it might not work, as you experienced with your cat, by just placing food in the carrier and hoping it will go there. But secondly, if the cat does follow the food may be that enticing that it follows the food into the cat carrier. And then once the food is gone, as inevitably will happen, the cat will think, oh, crumbs, I'm in the cat carrier. How on earth did I get here? And it can't actually cope with being in the cat carrier without the distraction of constant supply of food. So instead, we need to use this shaping procedure where at each stage, the cat is making the active choice to go closer to the carrier and is rewarded for it and is having time to take in information and process that information without the distraction of food.
Okay, so then the next one is marking behavior, but that would be putting her scent. Is that right?
Marking a behavior. No, so we would say about impregnating the scent, collecting the scent and impregnating it. Marking a behavior is, I'll give you an example. Let's say that you've got the cat carrier out in the living room and you're sat at the other side of the living room and your cat comes into the room and goes into her cat carrier. And you think, oh, crumbs, she's done the behavior I want her to do. It's brilliant. She hasn't done it before. I need to give her her food reward straight away. But you realize you don't have any food rewards on you at that time because you weren't even expecting her to come into the room, let alone into the cat carrier. So you dash out the room and you get some rewards and you come back into the room and she's no longer in her cat carrier anymore. And you think, blast, I've missed my opportunity. What we can do instead is we can use a marker to mark that behavior to say, that was the behavior that I wanted. Thank you. Well done. And now will come a food reward. So you're buying yourself a little bit of time. And the marker that I most commonly use is just the word good. So if Cosmos goes into the cat carrier on the other side of the room, the moment he's in, I can say to him, good. And he knows that was the behavior that is going to be reinforced and reinforcement is on its way. What I should say is that initially in your training, the cat will have no idea that the word good means that a reward is going to come. You have to do a separate session of pairing the word good, giving some food, pairing the word good, giving some food, and doing that several times so that the cat learns the association. And you'll know that they've learned it because when you say the word good and they suddenly orientate their head towards you in that anticipatory fashion that they're expecting food, then you know they've learned that relationship. And then you can put your marker word into action.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with cat behaviorist Dr. Sarah Ellis about the book she co-authored with John Bradshaw, The Trainable Cat. Now, how about bringing another cat into the house? It's not something you really do for the cat's sake, but it is something that often humans will do for their sake, either because they think the cat needs a friend or because they want another cat.
Yeah, completely. People say to me, oh, I love cats so much. I'm so pleased to meet somebody else who loves cats. And I say, yeah, how many have you got? And then they'll say 6 or 7. And I think, eek. And they're always surprised to hear, you know, how few cats I have. Sadly, love doesn't always equate good welfare. And just because we love cats doesn't mean that we should have many. If we really love cats, let's have few. And in many cases, we should just have one because some cats cannot cope with living with others. So yeah, I'd love to demyth this idea that a cat needs a friend. It's not necessarily the case. And for the majority of cats, it really isn't the case. We can teach cats to live alongside other cats and they may become friends. But I would say there's a large number of cats out there who tolerate living with other cats rather than enjoy living with other cats. And that is partly down to poor choice, choosing incompatible cats, and partly down to the way that they were introduced. If I use a human analogy, if I may, imagine a situation where we came home one day from work and there was a stranger sleeping in our bed. We would be very, very, very surprised to find that person, but we would also be very, very wary of that person. And then if, you know, our partner came home from work and said, oh, this is my friend and he's going to be living with us now, you're not going to just accept that. You're going to be very wary. Now imagine a different scenario where your partner came home from work and said to you, I have a friend and they're needing a place to live for a few weeks or a few months. How would you feel about if they came to live with us? First of all, why don't we just invite them round for dinner? And then maybe we'll just try a weekend of them staying. And if that works out, then maybe they can stay for a few weeks. We would be much more receptive to the latter example. And that person definitely sleeping in the spare room, not sleeping in our room. So you can imagine that's a little bit how it is for cats. They don't get to choose that this cat that they do not know is coming into their home. And they are very, very reluctant to share the resources that they have, their litter tray, their food bowls, their sleeping places, with a complete stranger. Cats in the wild, free-ranging domestic cats, only really live in groups that are familial. It's the females that tend to live together in social groups, and that's only when there's enough resources to support a group. So we're talking about mothers, sisters, aunties, grandmothers, etc., and the juveniles. When those males reach sexual maturity, they will disperse. They'll not stay within that group. So we can start to understand naturally why unknown, unrelated cats wouldn't find themselves living together. But it's a situation we create, and our cats are plastic enough that for some of them, we can teach them to accept a new cat. But the way we've got to do that is using a key skill called desensitization. And that is that instead of just thrusting that cat in front of the other cat, we need to introduce them to each other very, very gradually and one sense at a time. So these cats should be fully accustomed and comfortable with the smell of each other before they have even caught sight of each other, because smell is one of the most important senses to cats. Then they should be fully comfortable with seeing each other through a barrier without the ability to touch one another. They will be able to also hear each other at that time. And only once they're fully comfortable with all of those are they actually allowed to be in the same physical room. All the time through these gentle, graduated exposures, we are rewarding relaxed behaviour in the presence of the other animal. And we find that if that first introduction goes well, the cats are much, much more likely to form a good relationship long term. If the first introduction is negative, then those cats are going to find it much, much harder to get on. So this gradual process through rewarding, calm and relaxed behaviour is the best approach to go to try to make sure they do have a good long-term relationship with one another.
And are your cats friends?
I only have one cat at the moment. Very sadly, I lost Herbie last year, but I did introduce Herbie to Cosmos as an adult, and they were very good friends. I have lots of photographs of them curled up together. We followed the exact procedure that was in the book, and I was very careful about how I selected those two cats and the time that I introduced them. We are about to get another kitten, and we're very fortunate that we have a house with lots of rooms, and it's very easy to segregate the house into different areas, so each cat can have its own area before they are introduced. And my husband has just made a very beautiful mesh door so that we can do that gradual introduction process where the kitten and the cat can Cosmos cat can see one another without meeting. So Cosmos I've had since he was only a few days old. And because throughout his life he has experienced other cats coming in right from a young age, he has learned that is of no threat to him. He's always had plenty of resources. It's always been very, very controlled. And because it's been a part of his life from day one, he has accepted that that's what life is about. Whereas of a cat that has lived 10 years with never even encountering another cat, and the owner suddenly decides to bring in a kitten, that's a completely different story.
Sarah Ellis. Go to writersvoice.net to hear the rest of my 2016 interview with her about the book she co-authored with John Bradshaw, The Trainable Cat. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.